Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroff here, CEO of ExamPro, and I want to begin by welcoming you all to this, the first teleconference of the 2025 season. I'm really feeling very pleased for you folks that you've joined, because I have no doubt, and based on past experience and feedback that we've received, we routinely get tremendously positive feedback that these teleseminars are very, very helpful, and I'm very confident that you folks will feel likewise. Let me just share with you how this typically works. I try to keep it relatively short. I don't like them to run more than 45 minutes maximum, but it can be shorter, obviously. I don't drag it on for the sake of time, but I just keep it to as long as is necessary to give you what you folks need to hear and not waste your time. That's key, and that's one of the themes that runs through all the work that we do at ExamPro. We ask you folks, especially up until August the 1st, typically, before caseless submission, we ask you folks to submit to our office during the week, if you want, you don't have to, questions that you've got for me. You're not sure how to present a particular case, how to defend perhaps a complication that you had, or you're just not sure of anything relating to the exam and specifically commonly to the case list. Submit that to us, and I typically will accept two, occasionally three people who have submitted to be active participants in this teleconference. Right now, I have muted everyone out, and only the active participants were given a different code to sign in when you called in, and that means that anyone with an active code is not muted out, but everyone else is, because you can't have 100 or 150 people unmuted. All the background noise will make the teleconference impossible. So today, being the first, we only have one participant, and I understand that he never gave us his the opportunity to give him a code to get in to be an active participant. So, Brian, if you're there, he's the one who sent this question in. Thank you for sending it in, and I can conduct this even without interactive engagement on your part. Although I will tell you, for the future, folks, it's far preferable if we can engage interactively. I will tell you, I never mention the candidate's last name. So in the unlikely event that I ask a question that you're not sure of, or you don't know, or let's call a spade, you screw up royally, no one's going to know it was you. So we remain anonymity, maintain anonymity, and I want you folks to be totally comfortable to give us your name so we can engage you. It's also tremendous practice to interact and speak about your cases, and in a comfortable fashion, defend your decisions. I'm not your examiner. I would far rather you screw up. If you're going to screw up, I'd far rather you do that with me than with your examiner. I'm a polite, decent, nice guy. I'm not going to be hostile with you. There are some occasions in the second half of the year when we're practicing more oral exam technique, where if you want, I'll ask each person individually, do you want me to give you the cold shoulder hostile environment, and which mimics the exam to some extent, or do you want me to give you a more kind environment? And I encourage you to take the hostile option, but I'm never, heaven forbid, I would never impose that on you. I will give you what you folks, the style that you want to have. It's up to you, basically. But for the first 4 or 5 months, 6 months, when we're discussing primarily caseless issues, it really is important to have that interactive capacity. So, Brian, I'm assuming you're listening in, and I want to share with every one of you. I'm going to read, because his question, he sent it in an email to the office. I'm going to read to you what he wrote. And this is such a fantastic issue to start off the year, because this issue that Brian raises it's absolutely essential. It's not only desired, it's essential that every single one of you going into the exam should be totally comfortable to handle this case. Brian seems to have a case that's particularly prone to the kind of question he's concerned about. But even if you don't have on your case list, and you'll see what I mean in a moment, even if you don't have on your case a case which is prone to this line of questioning, every single one of you must nevertheless be able to handle this conversation in the exam. That's how critical it is. And it relates to the route of hysterectomy. So let me read to you very briefly what Brian wrote in his email to me. He writes as follows. This is the question that he's worried about. He said, why did you choose a laparoscopic approach over TVH for benign hysterectomy? And that is an appropriate question, okay? Let me just read one or two sentences further. He goes on to write, the hysterectomy was for prolapse. And now you understand why I said this makes the question even more almost obvious. It's almost guaranteed to come up in the exam. He says, I did the hysterectomy laparoscopically with uterosacral ligament suspension. I then performed the colporrhaphy vaginally. It would be difficult to do that laparoscopically if you think about it, but still, I'm just nitpicking with Brian. I then performed the colporrhaphy vaginally as well as a mid-urethral sling. The challenge is, he continues, I'm concerned the board examiners are going to ask me, why didn't I do a hysterectomy vaginally? I need to be able to navigate this well. And he's 1,000% correct. And I'm sure every single one of you listening in are in agreement that this is a question that is begging to be asked in the exam. So, Brian, you're spot on for picking this issue up, and we're going to dissect it in just a moment. I want to use this opportunity, however, because it's a perfect segue. I'm going to give you folks a shameless promotion for our caseless construction course. Why do I say that? Because we do have a one-day caseless construction course. Most people attend it online, although we encourage you to come to it in person. We have it only once a year in person when we record it, and it's usually, I think, it's going to be in May this year, sometime in May. In any case, I need to share with you a couple of things. Number one, you folks have to look at your cases through a completely different lens to what you've been doing up until now. Right now, you're pretty much automatically thinking, what's in the case? What must I put down? You put it down, and that's it. And then you just hope and pray. Ah, I see Brian has just joined us. Brian, are you there?
Yes, I am. Sorry, I'm a little late.
That's okay. Welcome. We've just started talking about your case, but you got in at the right time because in a couple of minutes we're going to interact and discuss it in detail. I'm just
perfect.
Talking about an issue now which your case brings up. What I was saying is, and this is for everyone listening in, let me give you an obvious example. If you got an OB patient who's Rh positive, do you put down Rh positive on the case list? And I'm sure 99% of you would say no, and 99% of you have not done it. And I would say that's absolutely fine. Now, what would you think? In fact, Brian, I'm going to use you since you're live and you're an active player today. Okay.
Yeah.
If you've got a patient, this is not your case now. You've got a patient who's Rh negative. If it's Rh positive, you don't need to put it down. Most people wouldn't. What would you do if she was Rh negative? How would you write the case up? If she were Rh negative and did not receive Rogam, would you write it down that she didn't receive Rogam? Or would you similarly just not mention it? It's not critical. You don't have to mention it. But what do you think is the best way to write up such a case? What would you do?
Well, I think if I wanted to talk about prevention of aluminization, then I think that would probably prompt the oral examiner to ask me about it, and it would be helpful then. Rh negative, Rogam not given, and they asked me, and then I could explain, you know, the reasoning behind.
Everyone listen to what Brian said. Yeah, Brian, you are 100% correct. He prefixed his answer by saying, if I want to talk about it, I would put it down. If I don't want to talk about it, I'd leave it off. Let me give you another example. Brian, you've got a patient where you deliver a baby with APGARs of 3 and 2, okay, at 38 weeks. You've got the cord gases. Would you put down all the full cord gas readings or not?
Oh, this is a question I've asked myself. I think similarly, if I
and a lot of people are listening in are asking themselves the same thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. If I wanted to talk about cord gases, or if I was prepared to, I would feel comfortable putting it down. But if I didn't feel comfortable talking about cord gases again,
okay.
Putting it
down, your basic premise is correct. I'm just going to refine it. You may not be comfortable now to talk about cord gases, but given your schedule for the next 10 months. Do you think, because this is the bottom line, by the time you walk into the exam, you could or would be comfortable to talk about cord gases, which would prompt you to put it in on your case list?
Yes, I could. And the one thing I worry, too, is if the examiner sees, APGAR is that low, they may ask me why and how I evaluated. And if I didn't have a cord gas, maybe I wouldn't be able to respond appropriately. I don't know, that's the thought.
So you'd put down the pH, the base excess, the bicarb and all that, you know, the whole reading what they give us, yeah?
Right.
Okay. So now I'm going to play the role of the examiner. Dr. Brian, how do you distinguish between metabolic acidosis versus respiratory acidosis or alkalosis? How do you tell the difference? How comfortable are you with that question? Be honest.
I'm
we need to be honest with each other. You are?
No,
are you MFM? Are you MFM?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm not. I think I'm comfortable. I'm not. No. I'm not MFM.
Okay. Good for you. Good for you. But I'm sure everyone listening in is thinking, oh, my goodness, do I need to know that? And the point that I want to make is, no, you don't. If this were an MFM exam, I would answer differently. But at the general board exam, if you don't know the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, you're not going to lose anything. So don't freak out. If you find, like Brian said, if they're going to ask me how did this arise, I would go to the cord gas, and all I would put down is the pH. I'd leave everything else off. And if they asked you anymore, you remember in your head, if you can, what the base excess was. But don't give them all that other information. Because by giving that information on paper, you're just increasing the likelihood of getting that question of metabolic versus respiratory acidosis, which, you know, Brian might be an immortal human being, but us mere mortals, myself included, I would not like to handle that question. I'm a generalist, by the way, okay? So the point that I'm trying to make is, and this is what we show you in spades, we show you how to construct your case list in such a way that it forces the examiner to ask certain questions and that you obviously want, and minimizes the probability of being asked questions that you don't want. So coming back just briefly to that Rh negative case, most of us, I'm sure, are probably uncomfortable to talk about us immunization. And if we're not now, we certainly will be by the time we walk into the exam. So if that's a given, if that's how you feel about ICE immunization, then a conversation on ICE immunization is a great conversation for you to have, because you'll impress your examiner. So if it's a good, if it's a desired conversation, then we want to light it up and try and work out a way to encourage the examiner to ask questions. So I would say, on the case list, I would write Rh negative, and then in the treatment column, after whatever else has been added, I would write Rogam not given with 3 exclamation marks after that. Because when the examiner sees that, and you might even, if you can, I don't know if the software allows it, you can bold it, underline it, italicize it, make it prominent. You want the examiner to see it. And when they see Rogam not given, Brian, when they see that, what's the next question they're going to ask you?
Why?
Why not? And there you've got your introduction to ICE immunization. And it starts off, well, if the father's Rh negative, which is one of the first things I test for, then there's no need. And if she's already been ICE immunized, then there's no need. But this is the standard protocol, and then that leads into the whole conversation. So what I'm getting at here, I want you to, every case that you've got, and we're already 7 months, 8 months into collecting cases, I want you to really think about each case and ask yourself, and by the way, what I'm describing now, I call it reverse engineering. Don't just what you would have done up until this point, write the case down, and there's hope that you can answer whatever questions arise from it. Rather reverse the process. Ask yourself, what questions do I want to get on this case? What kind of questions can I get the examiner to ask me? What subjects relating to this case would I be comfortable to talk about, and would I shine in the exam? Once you've got the topics and you've got the questions you're looking for, write the case up in such a way that it begs the question, okay? I'll give you another quick, silly example. You've all got hysteroscopy on your case list. In the complications column of your hysteroscopy, right there, borderline water, what's the word I'm looking for, not intolerance, water imbalance, okay, water intoxication, or rule out water intoxication. You didn't get water intoxication. It was close. It was borderline. But you've got the words water imbalance on your case list. You're basically forcing the examiner, Brian, you can agree or disagree, what do you think? You're forcing your examiner to ask you, why did you think you almost had water imbalance? How do you manage your eyes and nose? Do you think that's a fair question to be asked if you've written that down on paper?
Oh, I definitely, yeah.
Okay. So, folks, what I'm saying is I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg. This is what I call reverse engineering, and it works like a charm. And some of you are probably thinking, but won't the examiner realize that this is what I'm doing? And I can just tell you, they may, but two things I will tell you. If you put down concern for possible bowel for possible enterotomy. There wasn't an enterotomy, but you thought maybe, you know, you were a little, something happened, maybe. There was a concern. There wasn't an enterotomy, but you were concerned. You put the word concern for bowel entry. You've forced the examiner to ask you, why were you concerned? And once you've got that question, the question becomes, well, what would you do about it? How do you close? When do you close longitudinally, transversely, etc.? So you've got to decide all of this. At our cases in construction course, we go into detail about reverse engineering. As I said, I've only given you the tip of the iceberg now. But I'm pleased I've been able to share this with you because I want you to understand that your case list can be your, should be your biggest friend, but it can also be your worst enemy. And I've seen case lists tragically after submission. Okay, if I saw them for review before submission, I could have done something about it. They were, and when I say do something, I'm never going to tell you folks to be dishonest. Never. That's not the way to go. But there's a way you can present certain things. And I've seen case lists where the candidate has all but failed, and they haven't even walked into the exam room. So please, folks, I'm just going to tell you your case list is 50% of your exam. I have had countless candidates on whom I've done a case list review who came back to me after the exam and said every single question that I'd predicted for them in the exam came up. And folks, if you know 50% of the questions before you walk in, it's very difficult to fail. I'm not saying you need to have me review your case list, but what I am saying is you folks can accomplish this to a large extent on your own, and I encourage you to do this. We'll talk all about this at the cases construction course. I will add one last thing before we go into Brian's case. If you're going to attend the cases construction course, come as soon as you possibly can, because it will change completely the way you look at your case list. And so the sooner you can get that insight, the sooner you can start collecting cases and entering cases in a far more appropriate and beneficial way. All right. So, Brian, let's get back to your case. You had a case of prolapse, and you did it laparoscopically. And I'm going to ask you the exact question that you're worried about. Let's role play. I'll be kind. Okay. Don't worry. And I'm the examiner, so tell me why didn't you do this vaginally?
Well, my residency training, I've become very comfortable in laparoscopic surgery and have great outcomes. We've also found a way to suspend uterosacral ligaments laparoscopically with good success. But when I consider the approach to hysterectomy, you know, it all depends on if there is uterine pathology, and if I'm concerned.
Okay, before you go on, I want to interrupt you for 1 second.
Yeah.
If you had a 6-week uterus with prosodentia, I hear that you're more experienced and more comfortable with the laparoscopic approach. Right. But if all you had to do was remove the uterus for the prosodentia, would you do it laparoscopically or vaginally?
Because I'm not comfortable.
Folks, for all of you listening in, for all of you listening in, what I'm trying to do with Brian, I'm trying to remove all the fluff and just get straight down to the bare bones issue. Okay? So go ahead, Brian. What would you do in that situation?
The best approach would be a transvaginal.
What would you do? No, what would you do?
I would offer referral to a urogynecologist that would be comfortable doing that.
Okay, so you've been doing great up until now, but you just gave it to the wrong answer. And but this is so damn important. I'm so pleased we're having this conversation for you and for everyone listening in. The mistake that you made, and it's so inconsequential in clinical practice, but it's majorly consequential in the exam. You've said, in essence, even when the uterus is in your lap, You're still not going to do a TVH. I've given you the easiest kind of TVH to do, and you said you're going to give it to someone else. Okay?
Yeah.
Let me up the ante with you.
Okay.
If you're doing a labor and delivering a patient, and she needs a C-section, are you going to give it to someone else because you don't do C-sections?
No. But I do.
So the point that I'm making is, and listen, a lot of people listening in probably feel very, very similarly to you, Brian. I'd say maybe 20 to 30% feel similar. It's not a small number. Feel the likewise with you. But from the I'm going off at a tangent now, okay, folks? There's so much I can share with you, and time's already spinning away. What was the point I wanted to make? You said about the TVH that you would do it regardless, you would send it out. The vaginal hysterectomy is one of the tools that we have in our toolbox that we need to be able to do. You can't expect an examiner to say, you don't do vaginal hysterectomies and be comfortable. I mean, they might still pass you, but it makes it a little difficult for them. They expect you to be able to do a TVH. That's the bottom line. Now, a third of you are freaking out because you're saying, I don't have any TVHs on my cases. What am I going to do? That's absolutely fine. That's not a problem. The problem is the way Brian presented it. I would say the following. You know, in my experience, I was given during residency tremendous exposure to the laparoscopic approach to the point that I'm quicker, better. I think I'm safer with a laparoscopic approach, and my patients go home in roughly the same amount of time. And so in my hands, a laparoscopic approach is the best. That being said, I readily, and this is the part you started on, but you need to embellish a little more. That being said, I have to acknowledge a TVH is the best approach for the following reasons, and you give the pros and cons. And as a consequence of the fact that I never got any, I didn't get any real TVH exposure in residency, what I'm doing now, whenever I have an associate or a partner who's doing a TVH, I ask them if I can come scrub in with them. Because my plan is over the next couple of years to get enough experience that I'm comfortable to do it in a safe fashion. But at the moment, having just finished residency recently, this is my comfort level, but I believe it will change over the next couple of years. How does that sound to you, Brian?
I like that, and I guess that
you can disagree with me, by the way.
To get better, and no, I do like that. Yeah, yeah. I think the hard part is I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm hoping examiners will see. You know, a lot of residency training is approaching laparoscopic and not so much transvaginal, and it's still a minimally invasive approach. So, I think that
yes, but for the purposes of the exam.
Yeah.
An incision at the top of the vagina is still better than an incision at the top of the vagina plus a couple of incisions, or tiny incisions on the abdomen.
Right, that's true.
And
yeah,
I'm guessing you probably don't want to argue against that. I mean, you can put up a strong argument, but you probably wouldn't be comfortable. You understand?
Right.
And that's the bottom line. I'm cutting to the chase here, obviously. Okay?
Right.
So I just had to interrupt and go off at a tangent on that one thing that you said. Let me give you my what I will call is a model answer. Okay, I'm tooting my own horn here a little bit, but this is how I would answer the question that Brian's so concerned about. Why did you not do this as a TVH? I would answer in the following fashion. You know, I believe that every hysterectomy is a TVH unless contraindicated. It's the quickest, the least morbid, the most rapid recovery, as you can give all the pros and cons of one versus the other. If I'm unable to accomplish a TVH for reasons which I'll mention in a moment, the next best is a laparoscopic approach. And only if a laparoscopic approach is contraindicated, and I'll be happy to give reasons for that in a moment, only then would I consider an open abdominal approach. But the TVH is the best approach. So whenever I get a hysterectomy, I look to see, is there anything in this particular case that would prevent me from safely doing a hysterectomy, a vaginal hysterectomy? So the first thing I look at is size. And folks, on this issue, I'm jumping outside of the self-created exam box in which I'm speaking. When it comes to size, some of us are comfortable to do a vaginal hyst at 12 weeks, 10 weeks, 6 weeks. Don't feel bad if you're only comfortable to remove a 6-week uterus vaginally. As long as you can show you can do it safely, that's all that counts. Now, if you can do it at 12 weeks, that's just a nice feather in your cap. But the converse, if you can only do a 6-week, I don't want you folks to feel bad, okay? As long as you know what your cutoff is and you stick by it, that's absolutely fine. Continuing with my response. So the first thing I look at is size. The next thing I look at is the shape of the uterus. You know, if there are large fibroids, one on top of the other on the fundus, it doesn't really affect my decision that much. But if there are even small fibroids on the lateral sides, that could be a problem. So it's not only the size of the uterus, but it's the shape of the uterus as well. I then consider, is there any need to take the adnexa, which may preclude me, depending on descent, doing a TVH? I then ask myself, is there any need to do any other intra-abdominal surgery, which again would preclude a TVH? I then look at the history. Is there a history of chronic pelvic pain, endometriosis, PID, previous abdominal or pelvic surgery, which might result in adhesions and complicate my vaginal approach to a point that would make it very difficult? And then I obviously look at her past obstetric history. How many vaginal deliveries has she had? What were the size of those babies? And I then also look clinically to see how much descensus there is of the uterus down the vagina. And then finally, I will look at the infrapubic angle. Is it a very narrow angle, which would make the surgery very difficult vaginally? Or is it a wide angle, which would favor doing a vaginal hysterectomy? And then I also look at the length of the vagina as well as the caliber of the vagina. And if it's a narrow caliber and or a long vagina, that would preclude me from doing a TVH. So those are the issues I take into account. This year of collecting cases, I had, and I'm making it up now, I had 7 hysterectomies. Unfortunately, all of them, there was at least one of those issues that was sufficient in my mind to prevent me from doing a safe TVH. But that being said, wherever possible, I think a TVH is the best way to go. So, Brian, I catch my breath and I ask you, what do you think? Be honest. You can tell me it sucks. I don't mind. But be honest. How does that sound to you?
No, I think that's a perfect answer. And like what you were saying earlier, if I have laparoscopic approaches, I just, you know, let them know that that's something I'm trying to work on, getting more experience at TVH to hopefully incorporate that in my practice in the future.
Yep.
Knowing that's
the best
approach. Yeah. I think that's excellent. Yeah, that's very helpful.
Good. So this is a broad approach to the question that you had. And at the end of the day, what you're doing in practice or what you've got on your cases is almost of secondary importance. What it's been superseded by the fact that you have been able to show your examiner, you know and understand the issues that go into making a decision regarding route of hysterectomy. And so that's a very valuable tool to have. And I encourage you all, every single one of you, no matter how many hysterectomies you've got, I encourage all of you to be totally comfortable to be able to handle this. Okay? As I'm talking, I'm just going on my computer here. I don't think it was this year. I'm looking at the MOC articles. Yeah, last year. Hold on, let me just check them. GYN. Hang on one second. That's my mectomy. I'm looking at the list of articles. Last year there was an MOC article relating to this discussion, but not this year. But we'll talk more about that later on in the year. So that's how to handle that question. Brian, I'm done with your question. Do you have any concerns or follow-up questions regarding what I said?
No, I really enjoyed hearing that explanation. I'm going to do that just how you did it.
Excellent. Good. I'm pleased. I want to encourage all of you to do this kind of thing. It really works like a charm. Okay, folks, let me just, we're almost running out of time. I want to just make a few closing comments. Number one, our next teleseminar, we typically do these throughout the year every 2 weeks. Come September through October, we have our Definitive Board prep courses, which start on a Sunday. And so we swap out. So sometimes it might be a subsequent Sunday and then 3 weeks thereafter. But basically, and certainly for the next several months, it's expected to be every 2 weeks. So the next one, the next one will be on the 9th of March, which I believe is 2 weeks from today. I want to encourage you to tell your friends to come and join. It's free. And I'm pretty confident that you would have found this all to be very beneficial. And let your friends join in. And so tell your friends about us. And also, I want to encourage all of you. You notice, Brian, let me ask you, what was your experience like at being on the hot seat? Please be comfortable to say exactly what you think. Worthwhile, not worthwhile, waste of time, what do you think?
No, I think it was very worthwhile because, you know, whenever you get in front of someone that's asking you questions, it makes you a little bit nervous, and trying to, you know, explain what you want to say in the correct way is hard. So doing this.
That's exactly right. You know, yeah. And to all of you listening in, what Brian said now is so important. When you're listening as a third party to a conversation and a question is asked, you're much more able to give a coherent answer in your head. But when you are facing the question, when you're facing the firing line directly, it's a completely different story. We're going to talk about the importance of having as much mock oral exam exposure as you can, but we'll talk about that later on in the year. But the point that I want to harp on now is to really volunteer to be on the hot seat. It's really worthwhile, and invariably, everyone who joins on the hot seat, at the end of the session, they say they're so pleased they did. Typically, they say, I was so anxious, I didn't want to do it, I wasn't comfortable, I didn't feel I was ready, but they force themselves to do it, and afterwards, they feel so pleased that they did it. So I encourage you to do that, submit your questions, volunteer to be on the hot seat. We'll be happy to take you through the same process that I went with Brian. And I think all of you would agree, I wasn't harsh on Brian. He said something that I disagreed with. Brian, I told you the way you spoke about not doing TVHs was wrong, but did you feel insulted by it?
Not at all.
You might say yes.
Learn what I need to change and how I speak. Yeah.
Okay.
I learned.
All right, but I'm a benign guy is what I'm saying. The examiners might not be as benign as me, so you just got to be prepared for the worst kind of thing. The last thing I want to ask you folks, please, especially since this is the first teleconference of the year, can I ask you, please, right now, as you're listening to the end of this teleconference, go to your email, send an email right now to info@exampro.com. I want you all just please to rate this teleconference on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being lousy, 5 being excellent. And it takes 2 seconds to do that. Just put a number, 1, or hopefully it won't be 1, but whatever you honestly feel it is, 5 out of 5, 2 out of 5. Because we do track how we do. And if you want to add any additional comments, we really do appreciate it. Not because it makes us feel good or bad, but we use the feedback that we get from you folks to tweak the way we give these presentations. So it's helpful to us to help you folks. So please, can I ask you, it'll take 2 seconds. Send right now, write an email right now, info@examPro.com. That's examPro.com. And just rate us 1 to 5. 1 is lousy, 5 is excellent. And add any additional comments if you wish. We really would appreciate it. So with that being said, Brian, thank you so much for volunteering and being our first such volunteer. Your question was superb, perfect to set the ball rolling. Again, our next teleconference will be in 2 weeks, the 9th of March. And please don't forget to send in that email. That's it, Brian. Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone. And we'll do this all again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.